Welcome to Wired on Development Interviews. Today's guest is Dr. Brian Hoare, an occupational therapist from Australia who is probably best known for his contributions to the field of constraint-induced movement therapy and biomanual training in children with unilateral cerebral palsy. He has 34 publications, including two Cochrane reviews and a randomized controlled trial under his belt, and he's passionate about bridging the gap between research and clinical practice through his company CP Teaching. He currently practices as a clinician and has also had time to develop his own iPhone app called CP Toys. Now, if you've been listening to Wired on Development for a while, you'll know there's a wee bias towards NDT, so it was interesting and thought-provoking to get the perspective of an excellent OT who's not an NDT or SI fan, particularly contrasting with the brilliant OT Kim Bothell's interview from last month. Brian's experiences and thoughts on bottom-up versus top-down approaches, goal-directed versus task-specific training, and intensive therapy are things I would have loved to dig deeper into. He also had so much knowledge to share, we only scratched the surface of these. You can delve a little deeper by following the links to all the things mentioned in this interview on the Wired on Development website, www.wiredondevelopment.com, where you can also sign up for the Seriously Smart Snippets. These are bite-sized emails with useful snippets from past interviews to enhance your learning and keep you inspired. Brian's interview is packed with practical tips, thought-provoking insights, and great learning. I know you're going to love it. Enjoy.
Get Wired on Development!
Brian Hoare, thanks very much for joining us on Wired on Development. It's a pleasure to have you here.
A pleasure to be here and thanks for the invitation.
I really like to start out just understanding your journey to get where you are today. What made you decide on occupational therapy as a career choice?
Probably it's a direct result of living with a doctor, a physio and a few nurses. Yeah, I think it was quite by chance that I ended up in occupational therapy, I think.
It's an interesting choice. There's a strong female dominance in the profession.
Particularly in pediatrics, it's probably less common. I think for some reason it sort of was meant to be. I think looking at now the potential to get into medicine or to physiotherapy, I think the opportunities that have been provided by being an occupational therapist have been, I'm not sure I would have had the same opportunities, and I think I could have made a better choice even though it was a bit of luck.
So was it always going to be pediatrics or did you come into it sort of with a more just generalist expectation?
I must say I wasn't perhaps the most high-achieving undergraduate student, mainly because I think the course was not necessarily geared towards a male's brain and of thinking, and I wasn't necessarily a very reflective learner, which was the main sort of teaching and learning principles at the university at the time. And also, probably the last person to have been predicted to be involved in research as an undergraduate as well later on. I graduated in 1999 and I did my final year placement here in pediatrics. And I think from that point on, I sort of said, that's what I want to do. I think had I not gone into pediatrics, I'm not sure I would still be an occupational therapist. And so it was that experience and exposure to sort of children and families and knowing what that was like that led me down the path of pediatrics.
So who were your early mentors and influences?
I think absolutely the first person that I sort of came across in particularly the area of neurological rehabilitation was Professor Christine Imms, who's now the head of school at Australian Catholic University. She was fresh back from Canada, and our OT association had a mentor program, and I managed to link with her, which again is just absolutely sort of opportune and by luck. And she really is an amazing person and an amazing mind, and wouldn't sort of let things go with sort of comments about what I was doing with children. If I was saying I was doing something, she wanted to know sort of what that meant and what that looked like. And in a way would call my bluff, perhaps as a younger therapist who perhaps thought I knew what I was doing, but perhaps did not. So that really challenged me, and that I think she probably sowed the seeds at that time of thinking more about evidence, having a clear, concrete understanding of what I was doing and why I was doing it. So particularly Christine Imms and then Margaret Wallen, who's, again, I think they're probably two of the most amazing minds that I've come across in my career. She was getting involved in some research around botulinum toxin. We made contact, and from that point on, we've been good colleagues and good friends since. But I think just having those very intelligent, pragmatic, clever people around you sort of stimulates that thinking and that thought around what we're doing and why we're doing it. So absolutely those. And then there's a core bunch in Melbourne, Melinda Randall, who's developed the Melbourne Assessment for Children with Unilateral Upper Limb Impairment, Sue Greaves, who's developed the Mini Assisting Hand Assessment as part of her PhD, initially a real core sort of Australian-based group of quite amazing occupational therapists.
When did you actually start specialising?
Shortly after finishing, I got a position at Monash Medical Centre, actually in adult orthopaedics, only for around 6 months, and really biding my time until perhaps a position came up within paediatrics. And there were only two positions, so I could have waited a long time. But eventually I got into a paediatric position in around mid-2000. And I would say that within 12 months of that time, I was starting a master's. I didn't get honours in my undergraduate degree, so the pathway meant that I needed to demonstrate some research ability. So very quickly I got into the area of cerebral palsy, both clinically and from a research perspective. And so the other mentors locally outside the profession was absolutely my current medical program manager, Professor Barry Rewicki, who's one of the most experienced paediatric rehabilitation specialists in Australia, and Christine Blackburn, a physiotherapist who had an amazing level of skill and experience in clinical physiotherapy for children with cerebral palsy. They were running a clinic really on the smell of an oily rag without funding. Chris's child was the first child in Australia to be injected with botulinum toxin by Dr. Rewicki. And they were sort of on the ball and really wanting the best for the kids they were seeing. And they had I think Chris particularly had the foresight to say that when it came to using botulinum toxin in the upper limb, that was really a specialist role, and that her job was to look at the legs and gait and manage that as well as she could. And so she invited me to be involved in that clinic. And that's really where it all stemmed from. I was really pushed into a clinical role without any sort of senior with experience in this area, because it was really a whole new role for occupational therapy here in Australia and overseas. In the year 2000, we injected the first upper limb. They'd been doing lower limbs in children before that, but yeah, particularly in the upper limb, we started in the year 2000.
That was your first experience with cerebral palsy and Botox, or just your first experience with Botox?
I'd seen cerebral palsy during my placements, etc., but actually treating children with cerebral palsy was, yeah, about that time. It was, yes, being involved in that team and the decision making around Botox, but particularly what to do before and also what to do after. So there was all the muscle selection, baseline assessment, but we knew, and I think everyone knew, that really Botox alone wasn't going to do much. It really needed to be the in combination with the therapy, or it was an adjunct to therapy. But the therapy we were providing there weren't the things like constraint or bimanual or goal-directed training. They were not defined at that time. So there wasn't a lot to be guided by. And so that's really where I again, wanted to know, am I providing the best possible treatment for the kids who are having their injections?
So you were doing your master's at the time?
As a result of meeting Christine Imms, who was had recently taken up a position at La Trobe University in Melbourne, she encouraged me to sort of start challenging, sort of, if there is no evidence, then perhaps what about contributing to that evidence as it's emerging? So that spurred me on into enrolling in a master's again, because I couldn't go straight into a PhD, and probably also didn't feel I was ready for that but with the intention that once you start the master's, then you can upgrade.
Right. So I have really two questions around that. And the one is, what did you do as a clinician to upskill yourself on cerebral palsy? And what was the experience like being both a clinician and an academic?
Yeah, so I'll answer the first question. So I almost could say that I'm self-taught in a way with good people around me who are both on the same journey. I will try and not be so controversial in terms of other interventions, say neurodevelopmental therapy / Bobath and sensory integration therapy. And both were not targeting what we wanted to improve, which was upper limb function, to be able to perform the tasks that kids need to be able to perform. Bimanual therapy still has only very recently been defined. Although everyone was doing it or saying they were, the key ingredients of what was being provided, I don't think really were consistent or really identified. And that's when I sort of started to read a little bit more, and I came across Taub's earlier studies in adults around constraint therapy, and I thought this looks like it's going to be far superior to what we're doing. That's when I started reading about and making contact with Edward Taub around constraint therapy, getting his ideas and starting to design the randomized controlled trial that did take me probably 6 to 7 years to recruit and complete. In terms of, did I go on courses? Did I have professional development opportunities? The answer is basically no. There was no guidance around any of those therapies. There was no guidance around botulinum toxin because really we were some of the first using it. So this is why, it led into that clinical researcher role. The next question, sorry, what was the second part of that question?
Just about the experience of being both a clinician and an academic and what that was like. Or is like?
It's a really difficult dual role to have, namely because you get pulled in either direction quite a lot. And I think once you sort of have a PhD, the pull towards academia and academic research and an academic sort of work life is very strong. And I think I could have easily have gone down that path. I had experience. So just to give you a background, when I was doing my PhD, I was working full-time, so 5 days a week, and I was doing my PhD treatment as part of my daily clinical caseload, but all the writing and everything else needed to be done outside of hours. So that was firstly difficult, and I probably wouldn't recommend that. I think at least a day or two a week would help with, and may have. Again, that's why I did my research over such a long period, or my PhD over such a long period of time. I mean, I finally graduated in 2010. So it is difficult because you get pulled in perhaps either directions. The clinical management and organisations will say we don't get funded for research, so therefore you sort of can't necessarily be doing it. So there's barriers there. The whole research life is about gaining as much research funding and really having as much output in terms of publications as possible. You can't do that as a clinical researcher because you don't have the time. You don't end up with number of publications to go in and compete on really hyper-competitive funding opportunities. So despite all that, I wouldn't have it any other way. I've had experience of being in a full-time research position when I was in Sweden. And although the opportunity was amazing to work with basically the most preeminent professors in the profession in this area, I learnt that what gives me my satisfaction and job satisfaction is working children and families and trying to be the best therapist that I can be.
How are you splitting your time in terms of hours between, because you're teaching as well and you're doing the clinical practice, and are you still involved in the research?
Yeah, so I currently work 4 days a week clinically. So that then leaves 1 day a week, which I have positions within Monash University Department of Paediatrics and La Trobe University School of Occupational Therapy. Those roles are really not necessarily designed for teaching at the universities, but to attract and maintain higher degree research students, so master's or PhD level. And then the CP teaching, it's a small business that I run, just to ensure that all this information, and it's a huge amount of information that's current, that's been collected over the last sort of 10 to 15 years, especially on evidence-based upper limb intervention, that it's implemented and that clinicians know what it is. There's the appearance that these interventions are sort of really highly specialised, etc. But in fact, they're often easier than perhaps what they have been doing.
Right.
So the courses are designed to bridge that gap. And then other things like the app development, etc., that's all just done in when there's a spare moment.
Are there any spare moments?
Yeah.
With all the research and the clinical work that you've been doing, what sort of aha or pivot moments did you have that made you sort of change your thinking or change direction?
Yeah. So I think after going through 4 years of university around what's occupational therapy and what's people's core occupations and how important it is to have these roles in our lives, and that therapy needs to be skills-based, that when I first started clinically, that there was none of that, even though I was working in occupational therapy department. Really, there was a predominance of bottom-up approaches where still, despite the ICF being well acknowledged and all in those days in its infancy, but well acknowledged that this is the ICF we need to think beyond, sort of trying to fix children and beyond the impairment level interventions, that every single bit of intervention was really trying to still do that. If you see a child who has a goal of wanting to tie their shoelaces, a bottom-up approach would get out the Connect Four and start working on some dexterity activities, get out the TheraParty and start working on some strength and in the small intrinsic muscles of the hand. And somehow magically that's going to allow a child to be able to learn to tie their shoelace. And that's, I can absolutely say that's what many therapists would still do when faced with a goal like that from a child and a family. But we know that if you practice tying the shoelace, probably in 1 to 2 sessions, that child will walk out with the ability to tie their shoelace. If it's a realistic goal, say for a child max 1 to 3. So I think the biggest aha moment is that we need to get back to our core philosophies, particularly as OTs in our profession, that it does work, and task-based training is what makes the biggest difference. And I think I'm seeing, thankfully, a really big awareness of that now beyond our profession. And I can say that there's a physiotherapist, Rachel Tovey, who's doing amazing work for gross motor skill development, particularly bike riding in children with cerebral palsy. She's not getting in the gym and doing strength and balance training, because riding a bike requires strength and balance. She's getting on the bikes in a park, in a school holidays, and practicing riding the bike. And by the end of that 2-week program, most of the kids are independent. So I think that's the fundamental aha moment. And if I think more and reflect more specifically on children with unilateral cerebral palsy, it has to be, and pardon the pun, but the aha moment is the development of the assisting hand assessment and Lena Crumlin-Sundholm's work, in which she's not had the time to publish, and Sue Greaves and I have recently absolutely acknowledged her definition of functional hand use and hand role differentiation in our recent paper in 2017 in the Journal of Paediatric Rehabilitation. That philosophy is around distinguishing the two different roles of the hands. We don't have two dominant hands. We have an assisting hand and a dominant hand. And in children with unilateral CP, that's absolutely exacerbated. So I think if I think back, and if you look at still some training approaches in adults, especially post-stroke, it really is trying. It doesn't matter whether it's your former dominant or non-dominant hand, you're practicing dominant hand activities. But in children with unilateral CP, I think the fundamental acknowledgement that's required is that we are trying to get these children to learn to have the most effective assisting hand. And as a result, if you do that, that's when you get the children learn strategies that they will use in their daily lives. There's no problems about generalization or transference of skills because they learn that whatever's an effective strategy, they will keep doing. And so, yeah, I think that's Lena's work that needs to be acknowledged there.
So just so I understand, you're saying that with the unilateral cerebral palsy, you train the hemiplegic hand or the affected hand to be the effective assisting hand.
Yeah, the most effective. And that's going to be different depending on the child's brain injury, really. And that's what we're starting to learn. And I think, again, the Swedish groups, Marie Holmefer, et cetera, has done quite a lot of work on the impact of the site and size of lesion, of brain lesion. And we know that not all children, and very few, are going to be grasping from the table with their assisting hand. But that doesn't mean that they can't have extremely good bimanual performance. It just means they're going to do things differently. And absolutely, they're not going to be using their assisting hand to be grasping objects or releasing objects to the table. But they can, again, learn to do very complex daily activities with their limited, perhaps active range and decreased strength, etc.
So maybe now is a good time to just talk about the difference between when you would apply or what your expectations are for bimanual training versus constraint therapy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is a fairly topical issue for myself at the moment because Sue Greaves again and I just recently published the paper where we looked at the difference between unimanual or constraint therapy and bimanual therapy. So when you practically think about constraint therapy, you put on a mitt on the dominant hand and you need to provide intensive practice. Oh, really, the mitt is only used to provide intensive practice to the more affected hand. And it is amazing the results that you can get, and particularly in young children, by doing that, you really change the context in which you're not trying to hold or restrain the hand, which physically, if you did that, absolutely is perceived by the child as a fight or a wrestle. You put the mitt on, you get fun activities, and you practice fun unimanual activities, and you do it enough, and you get really nice changes, and particularly children who have some selective motor control. And what I mean by that is that they have some ability to move their fingers. It may not be controlled, but particularly distal selective muscle control, in the space of 6 to 8 weeks, you'll be able to get that child to be able to grasp, hold, and release very effectively. Again, in young children, and I'm talking sort of infants, in those children, again, that have selective motor control. When you think about constraint therapy, though, and the activities that you are able to participate or the child's able to participate in, it is repetitive practice of unimanual tasks. And most of those tasks are generally grasp, hold, release activities. You can integrate different planes of movement, so trying to encourage bigger range of shoulder movement, more elbow extension, more wrist extension, say use vertical surfaces, etc. They're all unimanual type goals that you're working on. So once a child, and from my perspective as we outline in the paper, once a child is actively and spontaneously using their assisting hand, I'm not sure why you need the restraint, and particularly because all those goals that for that child now are going to be bimanual in nature. So getting back to what I said before about motor learning theory is that you learn what you practice. You can't practice bimanual skills in the context of a constraint program where you have a mitt on one hand, and which I'll get to later, I'm sure. But really what we're training here is not movements. We're actually getting the children to learn how to use two hands together, and that's a cognitive skill. So that requires planning, attention, the ability to problem solve when a strategy doesn't work. It's understanding what hand does what in a particular task. It's also very much, if we think about perceptually what we're doing, then we present a unimanual toy in front of a child and they've got no restraint on. Of course, they're going to reach with their dominant hand to grasp that, and most humans will. But if you're presented with a bimanual toy and you have no previous experience of using, handling, sort of what that toy feels like with two hands, I think perceptually you don't know where to start. So, of course, you might give it a go. You get frustrated. You perhaps throw it off the table. And we know that many of the children with unilateral CP we see do have behaviours, and I think absolutely it's related to the fact that they don't know where to start and life's frustrating. So with bimanual therapy, we are using toys to provoke certain goal-related bimanual actions and behaviours. So if I put two objects in front of a child, the child learns that they need to use two hands for certain objects and how they're placed and how they're positioned. And you can only do that, again, by having, firstly, two objects, and secondly, by having an environment in which the child can sit and think about what they're going to do before they do it. And that's the trick of being a skilled therapist, is to be able to control the environment, get them to think, get them to consider what they're going to do before they do it.
I know when you did your randomized control trial in 2012, you compared Botox to bimanual and Botox to constraint-induced movement therapy, and the results came out that they were equally effective. Is that a good summary of it?
So the whole preface and hypothesis of that study was that due to the intensity of constraint therapy, my hypothesis that was constraint would be much more effective than bimanual therapy or current practice.
So was the constraint applied more intensively than the bimanual?
Yeah. So on average, it was 90 hours in the constraint group versus 30 hours in the bimanual group.
Mm-hmm.
And so the statistics that we used was to answer the question, is constraint superior to bimanual therapy? And the answer is that no, both were equally as effective as each other.
Mm. So did that surprise you?
If you had have asked me, that was when I first put the study design together, absolutely I thought constraint would be much more effective. From the reading around constraint at the time, it was going to be, I felt, very much the more superior approach. But again, I was the therapist that provided therapy for both the constraint and the bimanual group, and probably with time and thinking about what are we actually training, and probably halfway through the trial, I would have changed and thought that perhaps, and seeing the outcomes, is that perhaps, no, there's more to this than just actually doing lots and lots of unimanual activities. And so the result in the end was not surprising.
So what did it teach you as a clinician going through that process?
That we need to be flexible in our thinking. Absolutely. Yeah. So I absolutely thought constraint was going to be the way of the future, and that was going to be the ultimate sort of intervention for all children with CP. So firstly, it challenged my thoughts and really challenged my flexibility of thinking, and then also it just really, most importantly, set me on this path of understanding, well, it's absolutely not all about intensity. I can tell you that intensity is important, but much more important for constraint therapy, and that's mainly due to the nature of the learning that takes place, which really through constraint you are working on implicit learning, and that is implicit learning we know that you have to do, and that's learning by doing, and the only way to learn by doing is to do it a lot. Bimanual therapy, however, is really taps into explicit learning. So that's understanding how things work. So you need to, yes, practice, because it's not absolutely not mutually exclusive from implicit learning. While you're thinking about and doing things, you've got to do them enough for it to stick. So that's where I think the biggest learning that I took away from that is there's more to it than just doing lots of something.
Right. So you're saying with the bimanual, you're tapping into other systems that are supporting the progress.
Yeah, much higher level cognitive systems. Right. So you need a lot more attention. You need a lot more concentration. You need a lot more perceptual skills. So looking at something, coming up with a plan before you do it. You need to be able to self-monitor, self-regulate, and then you need to check what you've done after and did that work or didn't it work. I think you need some of those skills and constraint, but absolutely not to the degree of bimanual therapy.
So what has changed in your practice then with regards to when you're choosing to do one or the other or both?
So I'm quite clear on when I see children in my practice and also when I teach that constraint I use in young infants to basically improve their ability to spontaneously use their assisting hand and to develop the skills of grasp, hold and release. They're uni-manual goals. So if we think about goals first, treatment second, which we should always do, medicine does that. You don't just sort of think about a surgery first and then think about what the client in front of you has. You think about, okay, what is the goal, and therefore choose the method. So when we think about constraint, if we need to improve the spontaneous use of the hand, absolutely, there's no better way to do that, particularly in young children with or infants with unilateral CP. But once a child has the ability to grasp, hold and release, so basic hand skills, and they're initiating, doesn't need to be, it's certainly not going to be as often as the dominant hand, they need to learn how to use the two hands in bimanual tasks. And the only way to do that, I absolutely, from a perceptual perspective, is to use two hands and use two-handed toys.
Okay, so even if you had an older child, if they weren't yet spontaneously using their affected side, you would start with the constraint, and then as soon as you're getting some spontaneous movement, you would move into the bimanual.
Yeah, that's my theory. Now, I think always when I teach, I emphasise the context in which I come from. So when I first started in this area, OTs were not seeing children until maybe two, probably three. That was the early sort of referrals. I can tell you now that most often we're the first port of call. So we're seeing kids at sort of 6 months, perhaps, sometimes earlier. Sue Grease would absolutely see them earlier. But we're seeing young infants, I think, at the right time, who are not using their hands or haven't developed those skills. So there's no better, again, intervention than constraint to get them to be using their hands and to improve awareness, improve spontaneous use, and learn to grasp and release, and then go into the bimanual program. But that's for children that are coming in at 6 months. So when I'm teaching, I go into centres and to organisations and countries where you might have a 4 or 5-year-old who's never had an intensive block of therapy before. And that's really different. And absolutely, I think constraints probably a really good way to go. It's going to be more challenging because I think that the older you get, the more intensity you need and the lesser outcomes you get. And that's in line with the knowledge around neuroplasticity.
With the baby constraint, you would use the mitt, but you wouldn't use it like they do when they put the casting on for 24 hours or...
It's quite uncommon in Australian context for people to be using casts. To highlight why is that we generally use distributed models of SIMT, of constraint. So what that means is that rather than doing really intensive daily bursts for 2 to 3 weeks, we would tend to do still intensive blocks, but over a longer period of time. So it may be, say, for young children less than 12 months, 30 minutes per day for 8 weeks. For children older than that, we tend to do 2 hours for the 8 weeks. So you're still getting a high dosage, but over a longer period of time. If we tried to use mitts if we, for instance, tried to do 6 hours a day of training in two-year-old, there is no way that you're going to keep a mitt on that child's arm. They will pull it off. So that's why in those really high intensive models, you really probably have no choice but to use a cast.
So does the program take place predominantly at home, or are the parents coming into the clinic with their kids?
Yeah. So this probably gets back to something, the question you said, what are some of the things I needed to perhaps change my mind on? And one thing I was thought about with constraint therapy is that you really needed to have that one-on-one sort of therapist time, otherwise you really didn't get the results. But I think decisions and thinking needs to be informed by evidence. And if you look at the Swedish studies, who really had a coaching model where the therapist saw the child once a week to coach and support and maintain the motivation for the home program, those studies show some of the greatest effect sizes of any studies.
Was that for constraint or bimanual?
Constraint therapy. So the Anne Christinelli-Ason study in 2005 and then a second one in 2011. So it really is a home-based treatment from their perspective. And my model was exactly the same, except I saw kids twice a week. But I don't think you need to do that. And again, that's based on the evidence from Sweden, that once a week checkups with families to ensure that, again, motor learning is around not just doing stuff a lot, it's about doing the right thing and what at the right sort of level of challenge. So what's the next step? And I think the role of the therapist in that is to inform parents of what are the next steps and what types of activities should be you be using to work on those next steps.
I thought with the bimanual training, part of the issues around that was that it needed to be much more therapist-led than the constraint.
Yeah, absolutely agree that there is, I believe that there's a lot more skill required to provide good bimanual therapy than constraint therapy, again, because it's due to the learning that's taking place. You're not just doing and learning by doing, you're thinking and learning by doing. And so you're thinking about what you're learning, these complex processes around how objects work together. I still only see children once a week, but I'm really, really conscious of making sure families understand what those specific goals are for the week and then for the program, and that they are really working on using really appropriate toys to be able to elicit those sort of responses and behaviours that are really goal related.
Right. So what are your expectations for the families then when you send them home with home programs? Are you asking them to set aside specific time to do activities?
So I'll start with bimanual therapy. Bimanual therapy, which is based on my protocol from the RCT, which showed that really there was significant improvement on the assisting hand assessment from families who did half an hour a day for 8 weeks. So my advice to families is to focus on 30 minutes per day of really goal-related activities that I spend a lot of time discussing and demonstrating during the weekly visits. We don't start a program unless families have access to the right resources, being might be equipment, might be seating and a table. And I should say that all this type of intervention is done at a table, particularly because of the requirements for attention and concentration. And so that's 30 minutes, which I find most families in Australian context can do. For constraint therapy, I would recommend the baby simt program for children less than 12 months, which we've been doing for a number of years, probably over 10 now perhaps, 30 minutes per day using a mitt and predominantly home-based with a weekly check by the therapist for 8 weeks. Mm. And then for the older children, so older than 12 months, we try and encourage families to work up to 2 hours per day with a mitt for the 8 weeks.
Okay, and then when does the bimanual come in?
So we would work in, well, I work in distinct blocks, so we would do a block of constraint, and depending on how the child is going, if it's a first off intervention block, say of constraint, we would probably or may have a week or two break between to perhaps prepare for the next phase and then go straight into a bimanual block. And then we would have perhaps a few months break and continue to do bimanual from that point on. And with greater distance between the blocks, and that's particularly around what you find is that the cognitive development is critical for these blocks. And if you try and, well, you can't move on towards more complex bimanual actions and skills without perhaps having a break and allowing the child's cognitive development to catch up. They appreciate the fact that they work intensively for a period of time, and they know that they've got a break coming up, and also their physios and their speeches and everyone else is asking them to do things. So we try and work in a, particularly at the hospital, in a team-based model where we focus on the specific perhaps upper limb goals for that intensive period, and then still working on other goals but not as intensively. And then they might work then on some gross motor goals more intensively in that break period.
Right.
So as not to overwhelm, I think, families with lots and lots of requests from different disciplines.
Yeah, absolutely. You do have to find that balance.
Yeah.
So there's a couple of questions that came through as well that are specific clinical questions that I think lead into some other topics. So So this one says, I have used CIMT in the past with an 8-year-old and noted that one of the biggest changes was in her awareness of her affected arm. The child was far more inclined to use the affected limb when completing bimanual tasks without the normal prompting. This proved a real benefit to the child and parents, as both felt that the reduced nagging and reminding created a more relaxed and happy family environment. Is there any recommendation of how long this carryover effect lasts, or how often you should look at doing blocks of treatment? which I think you've kind of answered already, but perhaps you want to just answer that one specifically around an eight-year-old.
Yeah, so I think this really gets back to what are we training in the different types of interventions, and also what are the goals. So always we have to think what's goal first, treatment second. So if a child presents at 8 years of age without a lot of active spontaneous use of their hand and they have some selective motor control, so could develop sort of improvements in their skills with grasp, hold and release, absolutely constraint. Many of those goals are around initiating spontaneously initiating use of the assisting hand and to improve those general hand skills. Once she's improved those abilities, though, after a program of constraint, she's not going to learn how to use necessarily, particularly in these children who have learning impairments, and it's sort of what I'm looking at the moment, is that a vast majority of these children have some learning, higher level cognitive learning impairment, that they can't necessarily translate what they've, or that improved capacity, to what they do typically. And that's particularly because in constraint, we're training dominant hand actions. We can't get the hand to be a stabilizing hand or a sort of assisting hand when there's a mitt on the dominant hand. So I would say that if you want to see translation and generalization of effects, so use the constraint to improve the spontaneous initiation, then use a bimanual program for that point. The main reason being is this child needs to learn that how to use this assisting hand to hold, to orient the object, to use it in a really efficient way when she needs to. And I don't think you can do that, and I don't think she will learn that, and therefore I don't think you'll get necessarily a long-term effect if you just keep doing constraint. I think Professor Torb talks about it as a transfer package. But to be quite honest, what a transfer package is doing bimanual therapy, from my perspective, is because the kids are not learning to use their hand as an assisting hand. So yes, great, they get great capacity, so ability to move and increase range, increase strength, increase dexterity, but that's not in the context of an assisting hand role. So that's why I think the transfer package to us is that you would go straight into very shortly after, into a bimanual program so the children can learn to use the two hands together.
So are you, do you sometimes find yourself needing to go back to a constraint-induced model, or do you find if you do the bimanual well that you don't need to go back to constraint?
So this actually came, I was teaching last week in Darwin, and this came up in one of the children that we saw on the course. The only reason I would say, and I have done it on a few occasions, the only reason would be if there again becomes a very much a unimanual goal. And I can say that in the context of the child that I saw on the course, and also the child I saw clinically, is that they had a really dramatic change in their posture of their assisting hand, so really detrimental sort of wrist flexion or loss of strength. And the child that I saw was because they had, that she'd broken her wrist in her hemiplegic hand, and the cast was on for 6 weeks in a really poor position. So that had a detrimental effect on her capacity. So therefore her goals were now around improving her range, improving her strength, and getting better unimanual capacity of the hand. And absolutely, again, there's no better intervention than constraint and repetitive practice in order to achieve those goals.
Right, but as a general rule, you find you don't need to go back to constraint?
No.
Okay.
I should also just highlight that the continuum in which I sort of follow now is that in a child that, for instance, comes to us at 6 months, they will most likely have a block of constraint therapy, most likely baby SIMT. We then go into bimanual therapy and do blocks of bimanual therapy, but we don't keep doing that forever until they're 18. What we're finding is that absolutely by the time they're looking at transition to school, is that they've got really good bimanual abilities. They're not going to be having picking up from the table with their assisting hand or releasing to the table. Very few children will do that, but they are really effective in their daily task performance. They have good planning, they've got good attention, because in fact we've actually been focusing on those aspects which are absolutely related to using our hands. We then focus on sitting down with the child and asking them what they would like to get better at doing, and that's when we go into this goal-directed training philosophy, where we just focus specifically on the child's intrinsically motivating goal and we work on that. So we stop doing these more overarching sort of global skill development programs. We focus on what's important to the child and the family.
Around what age is that?
So usually around sort of 4 or 5. So school readiness for sort of 4, and then 5, kids can start to say, oh, I maybe want to be able to put my top on because my friend's doing that, or I want to be able to pull my pants up after going to the loo, or I want to be able to ride my bike. And progressively, as obviously the kids get older and tasks get more challenging, that's what we focus on.
That's really interesting. My issue around that sometimes is that there's so many tasks and you might pick 3, you know, realistically. Where does that leave you with the other tasks in terms of carryover?
Yeah, so we would work on one task at a time. So this is, so goal-directed training, the language around that has been, I think, misinterpreted quite a lot in the literature. And Kristen Eliasson has clearly defined, and there's a paper by Mary Mastos as well, Mastos, clearly defined the key ingredients of goal-directed training. So that's not task-oriented training. It's not using tasks, etc. It is a really clearly defined intervention where, firstly, it can't be mum and dad's goal. It's got to be the child's goal. So that's why you can't really start it until the child's able to elicit their intrinsically motivating goals. It's based on task adaptation and task repetition to improve performance. And it's absolutely motor-based approach where you're, as the therapist, the mediator between the child, the task, and the environment. So sometimes it may be just a little tweak of the environment. So perhaps how they're sitting. Most of the, particularly children with hemiplegia, will be able to perform most of the more complex daily tasks independently, except if they have a significant cognitive impairment. So getting back to your point, one task at a time. And I can tell you that as soon as the child masters that, their motivation to then want to get onto the next task is pretty high.
The next question was, is there an optimal age or stage of development that using CIMT is of maximal benefit?
Yeah, absolutely. As early as possible.
Right. 3 to 6 months, did you say?
Yeah, so there's some studies currently looking at very early intervention, and particularly in Australia. And one of the studies is looking at children as young as 3 months who are eligible for either constraint or bimanual therapy. And so I don't think they've had many children start at 3 months, but they're sort of looking at 4 and 5. But probably the earliest I've started is 6 months or 7 months. And that's when you really start to see the early dominance, and particularly because more voluntary control over the limbs is developmentally appropriate.
The next question is about Botox. I'm interested in your opinion about the efficacy of Botox in the hemi hand. In your experience, have you seen long-term functional benefits, and for which movements in particular? What therapy regime do you use post-Botox?
So maybe we go through those things one at a time. What was the first point there?
Your opinion about the efficacy.
Yeah. So I can only really talk about the upper limb because of my experience. However, I can say that when botulinum toxin, so Botox or Dysport, we particularly use Botox in Australia because it's approved for upper limb in children with CP. When it is used well, and that is I'll define well in a moment, it can really add a lot of value to what you can do in a therapy program, and I think longer term outcomes from a posture perspective. I have to say that I believe Botox is, well, I think it's almost getting a bit of a bad name, and I think that's because it's being used poorly. And so really the difference between it being used well and poorly is firstly when there's not, and I'll say, an experienced occupational therapist who's involved in muscle selection and discussion within the team. So I believe if, for instance, a doctor sees a child in a clinic for 5 minutes, you can't understand how that child's using their hand typically. And that's really, if you're using botulinum toxin to improve function, it's more about what you see rather than what you feel. And that's particularly if you think about children, young children with cerebral palsy, particularly unilateral cerebral palsy, they don't present with spasticity. They don't present with catches. They don't present with stiffness, but they present with quite significant abnormal posturing on intentional movement, and that is dystonia. So absolutely, that is when Botox is used best, is early on muscles that are posturing due to overactivity from the brain muscle pathways. Once a child gets older, spasticity decreases and stiffness increases. So stiffness, spasticity and dystonia is what I would, the umbrella term is muscle overactivity. That's the neurological overactivity that we see in children, particularly on intentional movement and sometimes on fast stretch. On slow movement, when you start to get stiffness, so through the passive, a slow passive range, that's the muscle properties themselves changed. So they're shorter, they're stiffer. Once you start trying to use Botox on stiff muscles, you'll end up with weakness with no functional benefit. And in fact, most likely you will reduce a functional ability and in fact really detrimentally set back children's movement-based therapy programs. Absolutely, we need to, and it's getting lost, I think, now because of services structures and organizational structures, is that Botox is an adjunct to occupational therapy, particularly in the upper limb. It's not, we think about goals around Botox and then we do some Botox and maybe add some therapy. We have to think about the therapy, and during therapy, when you're seeing children, you go, well, is that posture impacting on a child's ability to grasp, to hold, to reach? If the answer is yes, then most likely they're probably going to be appropriate for some Botox if they're young. Now that's the children who use their hands. If the child is max 4 and 5 and not perhaps handling objects, then all of that goes out the window a little bit because you're using Botox more around caregiver goals and caregiver burden and to complement perhaps splinting and maintain splinting programs and to complement casting, etc. So I think we need to think about the aim, but absolutely we need to think about therapy first, Botox second.
Yeah. When I first learned about Botox, we were taught that contractures are a contraindication to Botox, but yep. It seems nowadays people will see contractures as a reason to do Botox.
So defining what contracture is, loss of range of motion, so passive range of motion, that's caused by a soft tissue and plus or minus a bony deformity. So older children with significant fixed deformity, so contracture, will have a degree of underlying spasticity and probably quite a high degree of underlying stiffness as well. So you have muscle overactivity, muscle stiffness, and contracture. Each need to be treated differently. Contracture, the only thing that improves passive range is serial casting and possibly surgery as a last resort. Stiffness, I absolutely believe, and we don't have evidence yet, that's why we're doing some randomized controlled trials, is managed through longitudinal stretch of a muscle or a sustained low load stretch, say night splinting. And then the only thing that treats the muscle overactivity, so spasticity or dystonia that may be there, is Botox and other sort of spasticity reducing medications. So each has to be evaluated, assessed, recognized, and treated differently depending on what we see.
Okay. So I'll just ask the other questions in this question. The other one was long-term functional benefits and for which movements in particular for Botox.
Yep. So Botox will not lead to any functional benefit is probably the most important statement. What will lead to functional benefits is good activity-based level therapy. That is constraint by manual goal-directed training. If a child, again, posture interferes with task performance or goal-related performance, the Botox will assist in changing that posture. It won't do anything for function. So function's much, again, particularly around the ability for, or the requirements for children to learn how to perform tasks. Botox doesn't do anything for that. What does is task practice. So ultimately, the long-term functional outcomes for Botox will, there are none. But the long-term effects of good activity level intervention plus Botox are positive, and you can see that in my study. That's exactly with the study design that I had for my PhD.
Which one was that?
So that was the 2000. I think you've said the 2012. 2013. Yeah. So randomized controlled trial. But you will see that that is the only. So there are, for instance, an example of my point there is there's 34 constraint-induced movement therapy randomized controlled trials in children with cerebral palsy. One is mine, and that is the only one that had Botox. All the 33 other studies that show really positive effects are from the therapy alone. So we have to really get back to what's important, and what is important is the therapy. What is can provide some beneficial effect in terms of improving posture is Botox.
So how often are you using Botox then?
Yeah. So I would say that I'm actually about to get a student to look at our longitudinal data. We now almost have 20 years of data in the upper limb. We use it well early. And when I say early, we inject children as young as sort of 14 months of age when the posture starts to interfere with function. What we found there is that they're really responsive because it's a predominance of dystonia there. Once we do that, we really don't need to use it much as children get older. So we may use it perhaps 6 monthly for a year or two. Then the need and the length between injection serials is much greater. And by the time they're at school age, it's non-existent. We're not really doing a lot of Botox in school-aged children, max 1 to 3. So those children are using their hands. We're not really doing a lot of Botox for, mainly because they don't have spasticity. They may have some abnormal posturing, but it's not related to spasticity. The school-aged children we're using Botox for are particularly max level 4 and 5 children, mainly around caregiver goals.
Right. So if you had a child that hadn't had that early intervention and came in around, you know, after 6 years of age, do you think, I suppose it's a bit of a difficult question to ask without being specific about a child, but you're probably likely to use the Botox then just to facilitate the therapy?
So it all gets back to the assessment. So most importantly for that child in that example is you want to see what that child does typically with their hand. And at 6, what goals would you like to work on? You see the child perform that goal. Most likely it's probably nothing to do with muscle overactivity. It's the reasons why they can't perform that task. But so you use your eyes to see, and then you use your hands basically to feel. So, and you match those two things along with the child's goal and their therapy goals. If after doing some sort of activity analysis, you think that there's perhaps posturing due to muscle overactivity, so dystonia or spasticity, that's interfering with task performance, then I would perhaps think Botox will play a part. If not, my feeling is that Botox will most likely, if those things are not ticked, then most likely it will be detrimental.
Detrimental in terms of weakness and loss of function.
Yeah.
Okay. And can you talk quickly then about how you use splinting?
Yeah. So I've spent my career trying to encourage families and children to use thermoplastic, sort of static wrist-hand orthoses or splints. And I think at Monash Children's Hospital that we've probably one of very few centres where we have had a philosophy of prevention rather than waiting for the known effects of muscle overactivity to happen at a joint. So we've been splinting very young children from the first time that we've seen them. Now some of these children are almost adults, and I absolutely can say that I think that their hand position is very different to the hand positions that I used to see when I first started in the area. So thinking about what a splint, and like any intervention, what is it designed to do? So firstly, it doesn't reduce spasticity and dystonia. If they've got functional hand use, so they're using their hand during the day and they've got flexion posturing, most of the time, if it's a sustained flexion posturing, they will not move out of that posture. So during the day when they're using, they might be using the hand, but they're not ranging that joint through its full active or passive range. So as a result, over time and through bone growth, and we know from longitudinal studies such as the CP Up program in Scandinavia, is that there's a large proportion of children who will end up developing contracture. Contractures results from a sustained immobilization of a muscle in a shortened position, and really it starts with stiffness and ends up with loss of range. So I am absolutely of the belief that static thermoplastic stretching splints, and not in a resting position, but stretching splints, which is very different from holding a hand in a position. Overnight when the child is relaxed, absolutely, because that's when they will tolerate. And secondly, relaxed in a shortened position doesn't mean a stretched in a stretched position, that it aims and does have an effect on reducing the likelihood of developing stiffness.
So when you say stretching splints, do they have joints?
It's a solid splint that provides a stretch to the muscle. So that's the long finger flexors and the thumb intrinsic, so particularly ductor pollicis and opponens pollicis.
Right. So it's a static stretch, but it's put in a position of stretch on the potentially shortened muscles.
Yeah. There is no evidence for that. It's an AMBER intervention, which means that it's not that it doesn't work. It just means there is not the science out there to either prove or disprove that. And we are currently I'm part of a multi-center study where we're doing two randomized controlled trials looking at the effect of wrist-hand orthoses in children with cerebral palsy. One study looks at children aged 0 to 3, so they may not have had a splint. The other study is children from 5 to 15 who may have some stiffness and contracture. They're large studies and we're following them up for 3 years and we're monitoring how often they're wearing the splints for. So we're well and truly in the midst of recruiting, and probably will finish recruiting at the end of this year for that study. So rather than wait for perhaps the studies to be done, we're actively looking at, do these splints prevent or mitigate the risk of increasing stiffness and loss of range at the wrist and fingers and thumb in young children, and also do they have a beneficial effect for older children?
So when would you not recommend constraint-induced movement therapy?
I don't use constraint-induced movement therapy in children who have no selective motor control of their hand. And what that means is that they have absolutely no ability to move their fingers or thumb. Now, that can be hard to assess, but I think in young children with trying to elicit movements, you will see that. And I must say that it's a very, very, very small proportion of children with congenital cerebral palsy, and max 1 to 3, who are unable to do that. So it's not a lot of children. But my reason for that is, what are you going to do with those children if all they've got is a fist that can reach out to touch? So it is feasible to do that, but in that instance, I think you can do a lot more in a bimanual therapy program, because they can use the dominant hand to learn to place objects in that and push objects in the assisting hand, etc., to pull and push. So that's one group. The other group of children that I would not use it for are those, as I said before, who are actively and spontaneously using their assisting hand already in bimanual tasks, because I believe that they need to learn how to use those their hand in for bimanual actions.
And what about combining it with functional electrical stimulation, just because that's an area that I'm interested in at the moment?
Yep. So functional electrical stimulation is a really interesting, I think, intervention. And we use it a lot in our paediatric rehabilitation unit, but predominantly for children who are on the acute ward who have come in with an acquired neurological injury. As you know, when you use what you use functional electrical stimulation for is to elicit that first stage, particularly of movement, in a limb where that child or adult is unable to initiate that first stage of the movement predominantly. But most children with particularly unilateral cerebral palsy have the ability to use their fingers and their wrists to perform tasks. If that's the case, I'm not sure why you would use an external stimulus to try and elicit that. And particularly because I think you can do a lot more intensive practice without the FES. Children with CP have very different presentations to children with acquired brain injury or adults with acquired brain injury who have dense flaccid hemiplegia. You don't see dense flaccid hemiplegias in congenital unilateral CP. So my feeling is it's absolutely got a big part in those presentations where you do have flaccid paralysis, but not in children with cerebral palsy.
It would be interesting for you to listen to Judy Carmack's interview that I did with her, because she uses it completely differently, just as a, we won't get into it now, but just as a kind of different way to think about things.
Yep.
Okay. I will. So, three excellent questions then. Who is currently noteworthy?
There still is very much noteworthy things coming out of Sweden. So the Karolinska Institute. So Lena Krumlund Sundholm and many of her PhD students. So Anne Kristen Elverum has developed the both hands assessment, which is probably the most exciting thing to happen in assessment for a long time. And that is the whole concept of and structure of the assisting hand assessment for children with bilateral upper limb impairment. So we can finally measure how they're using their hands in typical performance, and particularly the response to treatment. So what we'll see is exciting. I think treatments now happen for kids with bilateral upper limb impairment. So that's, I think, to be watched. I think Bert Steenbergen's work on motor planning and particularly anticipatory planning and motor imagery is really interesting, and I think is tapping into a lot of the cognitive and learning challenges that children with CP have. I think from a physiotherapy perspective and more gross motor, Rachel Tuvey, who I mentioned earlier, who's a physiotherapist who's looking at using particularly cognitive motor training principles in a bike riding group. And I know that she's really looking at trying to tease out the key ingredients of the motor learning-based physiotherapy protocols. And always, I think, people like Annette Manema in Canada and her group around motor learning theory and implementation in clinical practice. So they're probably the key people.
Perfect. And the best book to have in your back pocket?
Physiotherapy and Occupational Therapy for People with Cerebral Palsy. Editors are Karen Dodd, Christine Imms, and Nicholas Taylor. Perfect. So it's a really nice book that goes from sort of neonates through to transition. And each chapter sort of talks about evidence-based intervention and assessment. There's a consistency throughout the chapters about how we talk about the cases, particularly that we use. So, and I wrote a chapter in that on goal-directed training, but I think it's a really nice book and still really relevant.
Perfect. And what is your best advice to new therapists starting out in pediatrics?
I think my best advice is to... firstly, put yourself out there and jump into the deep end, and I'm sure you'll swim. And secondly, absolutely be flexible in your thinking. Always be challenging yourself and challenging what's taught and what you've been taught, and ask yourself the question, is what I'm doing the best possible way for each child that you're seeing and family. Focus on those core clinical skills initially. And I would highly encourage that most clinicians at some point get into a area of research potentially that they're interested in, dip your toes in the water. You don't need to do a PhD. You can do a master's and do a small project. But I think I can absolutely say and reflect that all it does is make you a better clinician and make you more, I think, get better outcomes and gives you much greater job satisfaction in doing so.
Oh, Brian, thank you so much for your time and sharing all your insights and information. That's just been so interesting.
No problems. Thank you for the opportunity.
I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as me. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts, please email them through or connect with me on social media. You'll find all the links you need at www.wiredondevelopment.com, including links to finding Brian online. Your feedback keeps me smiling. Thanks for that. Cheers.